Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Committee on Human Services to order, which is difficult at times. Thank you all for being here, and thank you all for coming, and those listening at home. We have a very special and interesting program today. We're calling it an informational meeting, and as you can see on your agenda, the title is Community Partnerships and Nonprofits. Committee, you'll remember that Co-Chair Tomei and I organized one of these with your help in the last session, and we thought it would be good to touch in again with some different folks who are doing some pretty special things in our community. So I think you get the gist of what we're trying to do. For those of you that weren't here before, we had a wonderful parade of folks who, under difficult circumstances, are providing services to people in our community through very unique partnerships, sometimes including state government, sometimes not. And I think we've got another nice group assembled here. I'm going to start right away with, I'll bring you up one at a time, if that's okay. And Elizabeth, will you come up? Elizabeth Remley's here. And then for all of you presenting, we'd like to hold to around 15 minutes. You don't have to take the full 15, because we'd like to have another five if we have a little interaction and questions afterwards. If that sounds okay to everybody, we're going to get started with Elizabeth. And it's very hard for me to call you Remley, but I'm going to, because that's your name now. And Elizabeth, we know you in the building for other issues, but now we're going to learn a little something about what you do with your golden heart and good time. And you're going to tell us about Mind Matters of Portland. So welcome.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. Co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Elizabeth Remley, formerly Beth Slater. I am in the building all the time as a registered lobbyist, but today Rep. Gilliam has asked me to come here to talk about what I do when I'm not being a registered lobbyist. Minds Matter of Portland is a chapter of a national organization that was started in New York City about 20 years ago. A few folks from Wall Street wanted to be able to hire really intelligent people after they graduated from college who were from the area, from New York City, and they couldn't find any qualified candidates because the really smart kids from New York City either were going to college and not coming back or weren't going to college because they didn't think they could go. So they started Minds Matter, and the whole program is focused around taking low-income students who are good students. They want to be in school. They like learning. And they help them build their academic resumes so that they can qualify for a four-year school with financial aid. And so in Portland, we take 15 students per year. They start as sophomores. They're from all the Portland public schools. And they apply when they're freshmen. They have to go through a rigorous application process. They have to write essays. They have to go through interviews. They have to be on time for their interviews. And then they are signing up to come to another class at the Self-Enhancement School in North Portland. I think Tony Hobson is here. We're very, very grateful for the space that SEI provides us on Saturdays, because without that, we wouldn't have a program. And we have three classrooms, sophomores, juniors, and seniors. They come for 4 hours. In the morning, they get SAT and ACT test prep, and they work on their writing skills. Those are things that they don't get in school enough if you want to be able to write an essay for a college application or participate in school. And then the SAT and ACT test prep is really important, because it doesn't matter how smart you are if you can't take a test. So, and then in the afternoon, and they have tutors. We have volunteer tutors who help them. They're all former school or current school teachers. And then we feed them. And at noon, we feed them. It costs about $10,000 a year to feed these students. And we have a number of community partners who provide us food for a lot of hungry kids for not at cost. New Seasons has helped us. Whole Foods has helped us. Qdoba has helped us. And we're very grateful for the fact that they understand we're on a budget, and they give us a lot more food than they should for the money that we give to them. And in the afternoon, they get a mentoring session for another 2 hours. And the mentors are kids, they're adults who are recent college graduates. They're 35 or under. They know what it's like. They remember what it's like to apply for college, to be in college, to have the experience of being a college student. And So the Minds Matter students get more of a practical application of college. They're required to read an article from the New York Times, The Economist, or The Wall Street Journal every week, and then we have a critical thinking discussion about that article. So they're getting sort of the world context from those articles. It's way above their reading level in a lot of cases, which is helping them with vocabulary. And they're talking about things that they don't talk about in school most of the time. Current events, social issues, things that don't affect them here in Portland because it's just a different kind of place than a lot of the stuff that they read about in New York Times and Wall Street Journal. Sorry, I know we're not in Portland. Don't laugh, Rep. Gilliam. And that's the program. And the program, one of the other things that we do every year is we raise money to send these kids to summer programs for high school students on college campuses. So after their sophomore year and after their junior year, they have to go 2 to 4 weeks. We pay for their airfare. A lot of them have never been on an airplane before. They certainly have never traveled by themselves. That alone is a life experience that's really good for them. And they go all over the country. They go sometimes all over the world to have an experience. They get to see what it's like on a college campus. They get to see what it's like to take classes from a professor. And I think the one thing that's really important for them is that they are going to these programs with a bunch of students who are a lot more qualified for a four-year college than they are. They come from private schools. They come from affluent families. And they are way more prepared for college than any of the students in our program are coming out of Portland Public Schools. It's not to say there's anything wrong with Portland Public Schools. It's just that if you come from a place of privilege, you have inherently a better chance of being able to apply and get into a college. So they get to do that, and then their senior year we help them apply for school, and they use their experience going to the summer programs and all the things they've learned to kind of decide to look a little bit farther beyond their universe when they start applying to colleges. And so we've seen a lot of kids who maybe had never been outside of the Pacific Northwest apply to college in the South or at New York City or in LA, places that I don't think they would have considered if they hadn't been asked to think about it. If you look at the newsletter I gave you, I'm there on the front page with my student who... her name's Anna Joy, and she's a very, very special person. She is one of the smartest people I've ever met. She's mature beyond her years. She's a distance runner. She has a lot of discipline. She was one of the valedictorians at Franklin High School. She came from a family where her mother was a very, very good parent, but didn't have the skills to be the right kind of parent, I think is the best way to put it. She was always wrapped up in a lot of her own sort of thinking about the world in a different way, and Anna Joy had sort of inherited some of those views. So when she came to Minds Matter, one of the things I think she got was to be around a lot of folks who were adults and role models who weren't her mother, so that she had a better perspective or a different perspective on life. And she's a great person, and she's done enough for me. She's done more for me than I think I may have done for her, and just giving me sort of a different perspective about things. I have a lot of really good things to say about her. But she was on mock trial. She did Constitution team, and she graduated valedictorian from Franklin, and she got into Wellesley on a full ride scholarship. And she's there. She can't decide if she wants to study physics or political science. She has to make a decision. we had another in the same class, Tarina, who you see, I don't know what page she's on, but Tarina is there. She went to De La Salle High School, I think, in North Portland. She was sort of a little diva girl. Her earrings, every time I saw her earrings got a little bigger. She always had her hair like done up in all kinds of really great hairstyles. She was extremely fashionable. If you met her, I don't think you would know that she was a good student. The first year that she went out on her own, she went to Barnard College in New York City, where she fit in. She wasn't different. I think she's used to being different in Portland, and she wasn't different there, and she really kind of got a kick out of that. She was really excited about, you know, having a lot of folks who looked a lot like her in New York City. And then the second year, she went to Johns Hopkins, and she found out that she was really interested in medicine and stuff. And so I can't remember where she decided to go to college, but...
So it's Northeastern here.
Yeah. So, and like I said, you would never know that she was a good student if you just used stereotypes to guess how someone was as a person, but she was a fantastic human being too. So that's what Minds Matter does. We just help these kids build their academic resumes. We encourage them to pursue their academic goals in an environment where maybe that isn't the coolest thing to do. And the fact that they willingly show up on Saturday for 4 hours, 3 years in a row, is pretty amazing. So that's it.
Very cool. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Great program. How is it funded?
We are funded entirely through donations. We don't have any paid staff. All the money goes to the students. So,
how do you find the students?
The students are identified by counselors in their freshman year and encouraged to apply. We have volunteer staff who work with the counselors at every college to remind them that they need to be looking for the students. And then we encourage them to apply. We do informational sessions at the end of their freshman year, and then they apply and we admit them for their sophomore year.
Do you mind me continuing asking questions?
I don't at all, Madam Chair. I've got cookies to distribute.
Oh, okay. Now I forgot what my question was. Do you look for low income? Do you look at people who would probably not continue on to college? Is that sort of what I heard at the beginning? And then I see somebody went to Catlin Gable, and I would imagine 99% of the kids that go to Catlin Gable go to college.
If you don't mind, the Catlin Gable student, I forgot to mention this. Catlin Gable, for 2 years in a row now, has come to Minds Matter and said, we really like your program, and we'd like to offer a scholarship to a student for junior and senior year. And so that student goes to Catlin Gable because they offered a full ride to one of our students.
Full ride to Catlin Gable?
To Catlin Gable.
So I'm going to keep on going since he isn't here. So who pays for the college tuition for these kids?
We try to set them up with full ride or work study or financial aid. So they are, some of them do have some debt, but we try to make sure that they get as much free money as they can possibly get, and we help them with all of those applications.
And my last question, how long has this been in operation, your program?
The Minds Matter Portland, this is our sixth year.
Thank you. It sounds wonderful.
Yeah, thank you.
It does sound wonderful. Other comments or questions? Yes, Representative Rick.
Well, this is really great. This is terrific. I'm really interested in the summer programs that you managed to put together. Is there a list of those programs? Is that what you've developed, your own list of where those programs might be? Because these are just great. These are exactly the kind of programs that a lot of kids would like to know about, parents would like to know about.
Yeah.
And they don't know about them, and they'd like to get them to those spaces. And by the way, I just love the fact that she was in moot court and wants to do quantum mechanics. I think those are absolutely perfect as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
They fit as far as I'm concerned, but I'm also very strange about that way. So
Representative Frederick, let me see if I can back up and answer your first question. The summer programs, we ask the kids to do some research so that they learn about the schools and they learn about the different regions of the United States and they make a decision themselves. But we also have a list, and if their decisions aren't on the list, we kind of discourage them, because the list that we have is a list of programs where we've successfully been able to get mostly a lot of money paid for, a lot of free money for them, so that we're not actually having to pay for the tuition, because these programs can be kind of expensive. And so we've worked with these programs. The programs really like having Minds Matter students there, because conversely, it gives these students who are used to being around a lot of their peers a chance to meet some folks like our Portland Public School students. And so I think they like the diversity for the rest of the students too. So that we do get some free money from folks, or we pay for it through donations. And I would also like to just mention that Azumano Travel every year has helped us arrange all of this stuff for us.
Yes.
And they've been really wonderful. Mm-hmm. So.
Yay, show.
Yeah.
Representative Greenland.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. Probably you're doing a great job. I notice none of the kids end up going to the university that they spend their summer at. I think none of them did in the group we have in front of you. Is that just accidental, or?
I think so. Representative Greenland, I think I'm not sure if that's a trend. I mean, I don't know if it's true for the other ones. We encourage the kids to maybe go outside their boundaries with the summer program. So maybe they know they want to stay near home for university. So we say, okay, we know you want to go somewhere in the Pacific Northwest for university. Please go to the South or to the East Coast or somewhere.
They go to Brown and then end up at PLU or something like that.
Right. But there are, we did have several students who really liked the geographical region that they went to, and so they applied to the schools in the same region as the summer programs. So, and I don't know if they applied to those schools and didn't get in, or I don't know the answer to that.
May I follow up?
Please.
Do you relate to the Aspire program at all? Is that a piece of...
Representative Greenock, I don't really know what the Aspire program is.
Program to get high school kids interested in going to college.
I'm not sure if any of our students are part of that as well. Most of our students have a number of extracurriculars that they're involved with, and a lot of them are related to their low-income status.
That wasn't a trick question.
Representative Thompson.
Talk to me a little bit about your donors. Are these small donors, corporate donors, big donors, government donors? I can't believe you can't do this without government assistance, because...
Representative Thompson, the answer is yes, except we don't get any government assistance. We do get, we apply for grants. We have, their executive director, Graham Covington, likes to say the grant writers are monkeys in a closet, and occasionally they spit out a really good grant proposal and we get funded. And we do have a lot of small donors. We have a lot of folks who really believe in our program and come back year after year with significant contributions. Every spring we put on a jazz soiree. Jimmy Mack gives us his space in downtown Portland. The executive director, Graham Covington, is a trained jazz pianist, so he brings his jazz trio in and they play music for us, and we select a few kids to talk about their experiences, and you can't help but give a few bucks. So...
Okay.
Thank you.
You did a great job. I enjoyed hearing about this when we talked earlier, and now it's great to have this presentation. Each person that testifies, by the way, Beth will be first, gets a Girl Scout cookie, courtesy of Representative Matthews, who put the arm on us on the floor today. His daughters are all here, and you can't turn him down. Just two quick comments, and then we'll go to the next one. My co-chair will introduce the next testifier. And I think about this, Anna Joy Gillis, and you're being the mentor. I too went to Franklin High School, and if I'd had a mentor like you, I might not be in the dead end that I now find myself in. And I think physics and political science are a wonderful combination.
I think so too.
And you're a testament to that.
Did you actually graduate from high school?
That's all the time we have.
Thank you, committee.
Thank you. Next, we're going to hear from Dennis Morrow from the Janus Youth Program. Thank you for coming, Dennis.
All right. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be here and not have to ask for money or pray, so this is good. And you'll be getting some... You have copies of my testimony. I won't go through all of that. I just want to highlight some pieces. But there's another packet of information that I will take you through. So put the other packet on top, and as we move ahead, I'll walk you through that.
Okay.
Frankly, I got an email or a call on Thursday and said, can you go down to Friday? And the first I heard talk about services that Janus provides for sex trafficking. And then this morning I looked at the website and it said, or your website, and it said, nonprofit partnerships. So we're going to talk about nonprofit partnerships serving sex trafficked kids. So that's about as good
great,
as I could do. So. As you're gathering your material there, I'm going to start out with a musical song by a man named Sir Elton John. She was just 14 with her life ahead. You don't need to know her name. She breathed her last on a cold stone floor of a Hollywood arcade. But fate's right hand isn't always just. It puts a lot of pressure on your faith and trust. She was just a little girl, not old enough to rage against the day. How did we get so lucky? Targets on the rifle range. Who gets to choose? Who gets to win? And who gets to lose? Blues never fade away. Sir Elton's lyrics were written in 2006, and they provided an eerie foreshadowing of the reason I'm here today. I only had to change one word. His original song was "The Girl Was 21." But as we now know, by 21, we as a community, we as a country, and we as a society have massively failed our young girls trapped in the jungle of sex trafficking. So my name is Dennis Morrow. I'm executive director at Janus Youth Programs. Janus is one of the largest, perhaps the largest nonprofit organization in the state serving exclusively high-risk youth. We have, and I can't even give you exact numbers, but let's say at this point, 47 different programs at 21 different locations. We operate in Oregon, and also we are the only emergency shelter in Southwest Washington until you get to Tacoma. We sheltered over 2,000 runaway and homeless youth last year. We had over 30,000 homeless youth that we made contacts with on street outreach programs. We have a teen pregnancy program that worked with 550 girls and their babies all under age 2. And we're also a registered organic farm. So we try and mix the rural and the urban together. We have a youth development project where kids grow vegetables and sell them in the summer to learn how to run a business and do better in school. I'm here today not only as executive director, but also, like many of you, as a parent. I have 8 children, all of them adopted, 5 of them adopted from the state child welfare system. I have 3 teenage girls, 2 of them are age 14 and 15, which is exactly the age of primary recruitment into sex trafficking in Oregon and in this country today. I always like people to stop and think, how many of you are a, pick one, parent, grandparent, godparent, friend, relative, aunt, uncle for a girl who is in 12 to 15 year age range? That's who we're talking about. And we're also not talking about Thailand. This is not international sex trafficking. Every kid I'm going to talk to you about started 30 miles from Janus in Portland. They're all kids from our homes and our home communities. Now, on May 18th, 2010, Dan Rather made national headlines with a documentary he called Pornland, which identified Portland as one of the primary hubs of sex trafficking in this country. There's been a lot of debate about that. Make no mistake about it, Portland is one of the national hubs for sex trafficking of girls and some boys, but mostly girls, in this country today. We could argue about whether we're number 1, 2, 7, or 10. I always say, what's the pride in even being on that list? And we know we're on that list. Since 2011, the Sexual Assault Resource Center, SARC, which is one of our community partners, has opened cases on 273 girls. Since March last year, 273 girls. Portland police will tell you they identify about 200 girls annually. We have an emergency shelter we opened a year ago. We have seen 78 girls through that shelter in 2011. Half of those girls were under age 15. Half of those girls were under age 15. 12 is our youngest. In Washington State, we had one 11-year-old girl that was brought in for sex trafficking. Currently, SART gets 2 to 3 new referrals every week. In Washington State, which doesn't have any services for these kids, so there's no reason to identify them, our shelters there, we had 27 girls last year in Washington State alone. So that's about 2 a month over in Vancouver. On the other hand, Multnomah County, although Portland is the hub of sex trafficking, Multnomah County has become nationally recognized for designing and implementing the first coordinated interagency intersystem continuum of care to provide services for victims of sex trafficking in this country. And I am proud here today. I'm always sad to have to bring the topic up, but I'm proud to talk about the progress that we've made. Now, this system is built through a very unique partnership between the county, the state, and Janus, and a variety of other local nonprofits and almost every other public sector service system that you will find. In July of 2010, Janus was selected by Multnomah County to lead a community planning process to design a system of services for victims of sex trafficking, specifically girls 17 and under. Now, this is an interesting process because we had to apply to a bid process to Multnomah County. The amount of money available for leading this planning process was zero. So we actually competed to volunteer for the county, which was the first time I ever had to explain that to my board of directors. For that privilege. The county wanted Janus to do this work because we have a history of working on collaborative projects with them in terms of runaway services, homeless youth services, gang services, and diversion of kids out of the detention center. The stakeholders that we brought together, we had over 25 representatives on our planning group. They included mental health representatives, alcohol and drug agencies, developmental disability agencies, at-risk youth agencies, domestic violence providers, local police department and sheriff department, the FBI, public defenders and prosecutors, district attorneys, child welfare, public health, the mayor's office, Commissioner Diane McKeel's office, and survivors and families of survivors. So it was quite a group. The committee had exactly 3 months to put a plan together, and they delivered. In 3 months, that group spent over 700 hours and came up with the first plan in this country to talk about how you don't just have a service for girls, but an integrated set of services. They recommend creation of a collaborative system of care that was brought together for them, and if you open up now your packet, the first big sheet on the packet looks like this. We'll show you our continuum of care. We don't have all of this funded, but this is the plan that we are seeking funding for. And whenever new money becomes available, the committee reconvenes because they're an oversight committee on an ongoing basis, so they reconvene to decide which is the next priority for where the money ought to go. But this gives you your basic roadmap. What you'll see in this roadmap basically is targeted street outreach to find the girls. You will find guaranteed 24-hour immediate access to safety and shelter off of the street for every kid. You will find immediate access to an advocate who will be with them for the rest of their life if we need it, because once the advocate attaches, they never let go until that kid is into a safe shelter or a safe living environment somewhere. You'll find short-term and long-term housing, and you're going to find a variety of specialty services, which look like particularly mental health and alcohol and drug. All of those things are provided by different agencies and or the state child welfare, and we work very closely with the police to put all of this in place. Janice's role in the system is multiple. First, we were the facilitator of designing the system. Next, the county asked us to retain a role of being a coordinator for the overall operation of the system. So if you look at your next chart, I call it the bubble chart, you'll see three intersecting circles. So this is how we do inter-systems coordination. You have a system of services for homeless youth in Multnomah County. You have a system of services for runaway and at-risk youth, and now we have a system of services for children who are being sex trafficked. In the center of all of those, Janice is the 24-hour intake point for every single one of those systems. So it's like an emergency room in the hospital. We get the immediate decision about which services the kid needs and make sure that the child is getting to the right service. Even if they show up at the wrong door, we're going to redirect them to the right service. So that's our first role in the system. You'll also find, this gets very complicated, this sheet is our protocol for how we sort a sex traffic case when it hits the front door of our 24-hour system. And this shows all of the different steps that all of the different entities have to go through in order to make sure, again, that the right kid is getting the right service at the right time and in the right place. We are also a conduit for funding. The county set it up so that if the county puts new money into any of these services, they can direct it through Janice without an RFP process, and we can send it directly to whatever agency needs the services. So if we need more advocates from the SARC, the Sexual Assault Resource Center, the county gives Janice the money, and then Janice simply directs it over to SARC through a subcontract working with them. That's a very unique arrangement for a government entity to have with a nonprofit. We do serve, as I mentioned, as a 24-hour crisis intervention hub. Youth can show up there, families can show up there. We have awake staff 24 hours a day. Police bring kids there, DHS bring kids there. Now, if you look at this little card, this card actually, when it's laminated, looks like this, and it lives in the wallet of every single Portland police officer. Because every police officer has a card that says, if you pick up a teenager anywhere in Multnomah County or in the city of Portland, this is for Portland police, one side of the card says, these are criminal charges, take them to detention. The other side says, take everybody else to Janice. So the police never have to guess at what number are they going to call to get help for a kid. They go to Janice, and it's our job to sort them into whatever system. That came through our cooperation with the police. Janice also provides emergency shelter, I mentioned earlier, so we can take a kid in, and for 2 to 4 weeks, but usually it's a few days to a couple of weeks, we can give them emergency shelter for sex trafficking victims. And then we have a long-term shelter, which we just opened in December this year. This is the first facility in the state where the girls and boys, if they need to, but the girls primarily, can come and live. This system is designed to serve multiple episode kids for as long as it takes. We know from national research they will be in and out of care at least 15 to 20 times in all likelihood before they succeed. We also know it may take 2 or 3 years. So we may see a girl 15 times in 3 years. Every time she shows back up, she's not blamed for leaving the last time. It's just like, how can we help you next time get farther down your life plan, farther down the road that we want to see you toward recovery? The last role that Janice has, which is unique in terms of our cooperation with the state, by the way, we also provide over 60 beds of residential care, long-term residential care for both DHS and OIA in terms of state contracts. But in terms of this work, we have a unique arrangement with the local child welfare system. First, DHS in Multnomah County set up a dedicated team of caseworkers that only has a caseload of these girls. It's the only place in the state, and we believe the only place in the country, where they do that. That team volunteered to be on that group, and they volunteered to work on Saturdays and overnight if they need to, so they're available to the kids just like we are virtually any time. And it does mean if a girl comes into care now, runs away, disappears, goes to Las Vegas, comes back 6 months from now or a year from now, they're going to be the same caseworker is going to be waiting there for them. That's our real goal, is to have long-term relationships established with the kids. But the other unique aspect of Janice's partnership is that we have a contract with the state to be the backup for the child abuse report hotline in Multnomah County. That means 2 hours every evening every single weekend and any state holiday or furlough day, Janice is answering your state hotline for child abuse reports in Multnomah County. While we're here today, our staff are answering. We have trained staff that answer the hotline for the state. What that does is many times puts us in a role of the police calling us with a child abuse report, or we call them because we get a child abuse report through the state hotline. They go out and pick up the kid. The kid will then be delivered to our 24-hour center, and then, based on authorization that we can make because we're working under the state auspices, we can then authorize the shelter, and then we work with the DHS worker the next day to be able to get the kid from the shelter back to foster care, residential, or whatever the next step would be for them. And again, these are intersections I want you to see that happen, from our standpoint, probably nowhere else in the country. Is Multnomah County unique in our use of this planning and service delivery model? I'm willing to say absolutely, 100% yes. We had a national conference of runaway and homeless youth agencies that are funded by the federal government. Over 700 people in Portland. We hosted the national conference in November, and our staff did workshops about these models of care. Nobody, nowhere told us that they were doing anything remotely like this. We took the upper-level federal bureaucrats that are responsible for the federal funding that goes to every runaway and homeless youth program in the country on a tour of our homeless youth system and our system for sexual trafficked girls. Nowhere did they say, have they seen this? They actually asked us if we would do some consulting to help them, because they had many agencies, or many cities, where they have agencies that are at war with each other and won't talk to the state and are afraid to deal with the police. They don't understand what this, the power of what this collaboration means. So, as I want to finish today, I guess I always think about, when I talk about sex trafficking, I start out being very sad that we even have to talk about it. And I have to say I'm very angry, because I'm going to tell you the truth. This happened on my watch. This also happened on your watch. These girls grew up underneath us in the last 5 to 10 years, and nobody knew about it until Dan Rather put it on the radar. So I thank him for doing that for us, but I think all of us need to make a commitment that it happened on our watch. It doesn't continue to happen our watch, and that's what this system is about. The youngest girl that we had was 11 years old into our shelters. She was being pimped out by her parents at age 5 to support their drug habit. And she was not from Thailand. She's from Portland. That's not okay.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your presentation. The program that you're referring to certainly woke up a lot of people, and we've been in this committee have been working a lot on this issue of sex trafficking, and we passed some really good laws, I think, last year. One of the issues that came up was, and you mentioned that these girls can come and go 15 to 20 times before they make a commitment to stay. So one of the issues that was argued when we were passing these laws regarding sex trafficking and the pimps and the Johns was whether or not the girl should be in a locked environment. And there was a lot of discussion and disagreement about that. And part, as I recall, part of the argument to keep the kids in a locked environment, because what we were hearing from the police and the DAs was that they would go through the front door and then leave through the back door and maybe take one or two other girls with them, and they'd be calling their pimps on the way out to pick them up on the corner. So there was the argument that they needed to be in a secure environment until they could sort of calm down and get the advocates involved with them and therapists, et cetera, until they could understand that their lives didn't have to be as it was on the street. So tell me how that is working for you now, because as I understand it, the environments where you're putting these mostly girls now are not secure environments.
Correct.
Is that true?
That's correct.
And so they can go in the front
they
door.
They can, and they
the
do
door,
leave.
And they
yes.
do leave, I'm
right.
assuming. So can you give us any figures about that?
Well, pretty much wherever you put them, about 50% run away. And interestingly enough, even if you put them in locked residential care, you see the same runaway rate. The difference is when they're put into locked residential care with other girls who are not like them, they take those girls with them. They recruit out of those residential programs. So part of what we've seen is you cannot use traditional programming for this population. They really have to have specialty programming, because they put themselves and other kids at risk if the program is not geared to be able to very specifically deal with them. The committee, our planning committee, our oversight committee, actually just finished a fairly extensive discussion of the issue of security. And where we got to is this. We do not, if you mean by locking a girl up, putting her in detention, absolutely not. Jail, absolutely not.
I know one supporter, I think, of JDH. That's not what
we're... Well, there were people who were doing that in the beginning. Next level is if you look at secure programs in the community, understand a secure program in the community still has to have a door somewhere that a kid can get out, because that's fire marshal code. There is no truly locked facility, and these girls will find a way out of that. We have looked at the need for some kind of a, nonetheless, secure facility or semi-secure facility that would have a higher level of containment than we have now in our long-term residential program. The challenge is and people are very creative, so what's happening right now is if they get a girl who they really think needs that, they try and get her committed under a mental health system. She sometimes has mental health needs, but she does not need to be in a psychiatric hospital. We have a bigger need than secure programming residentially is actually a detox center for these kids, because they come very highly addicted. They're physically and sexually abused by the pimp, but they're also addicted. And so what we're seeing is we're using psychiatric hospitals to do detox on girls who are victims of sex trafficking, because we don't have the specialty program for them. Now, if you want to look at healthcare transformation, I got to tell you, 10 days or 2 weeks in a psychiatric hospital is going to cost a lot more than a decent detox program, which brings them into something else. But that's the only thing, that's the jury-rig solution we're seeing right now. So we believe at some point we're going to need a freestanding, secure type of a program, but prior to that, right now, we're really looking at trying to get some kind of a medical or semi-medical detox for the kids.
I'd be very interested in following up on that in the next legislative session to see if we need to be looking at the next stage for these kids.
Yeah, the nice thing now, I mean, it's not nice, but we now have on-the-ground information. Up until now, it was hypothetical based on what other places had done, but nobody had really assembled this continuum together, and now we can really start to see where the gaps are in the continuum. Right.
Great. Thank you so much for coming today.
Right.
I know our time is about up. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, you kind of prompted this, and I was thinking about it. Where do most of the youth come from that end up in the sex trafficking industry? Are they Oregon, California, other countries? Are we seeing it out of Canada?
I'm helping you through the denial that we all go through with this. I did the same thing. Every kid I am talking to you about is from Oregon. Every kid I'm talking to you about that we saw last year was 30 miles from where my office is in the center of Portland. These are our kids. And what's happening is 12 to 14 is the prime age of recruitment for sex trafficking in this country today, because the younger the girl, the higher the price they can sell them for. 12 to 14 is the recruitment age, and what they do, part of what I tell people is I used to send my girls to the malls with their Christmas gift cards and say, go have a good time. This year, I sent them to the mall with a safety plan about what to do when they were approached by either another girl or a man who started talking to them about some of this stuff, because they are able to go out and spot vulnerable kids. 30% of runaway kids, 30% of runaway girls are propositioned within the first 48 hours on the street. That's the national number. So they see a vulnerable girl, they see her in a shopping mall, they see somebody might know her at school, and maybe another girl who is being trafficked at school knows her, and they start talking to her, and they're recruited in. They're all local kids. This is not. Now, they get put on a track, and the track might send them to Seattle, might send them to Las Vegas, and then back to Portland. If the pimps get scared, they will move them. But the girls that we're seeing are not coming from Seattle, Las Vegas, New York, and the other 12 hubs. They're coming from Portland, and then they get moved out of state. What happens right now is the pimps are moving them to Washington State, because we're seeing more in Vancouver, because the Portland police have a bureau now, or a department or a division now, that is just a small team that is just dedicated to looking for these kids and prosecuting them. And so what the pimps do is they move the kids based on where the least vulnerability. But these are our kids. These are all.
When we were hearing testimony earlier, Representative, we also heard that in some ways the kids from the rural areas are more vulnerable than the girls from the city, because they're easier to spot because they look more frightened. And so, you know, kids in your district are no safer than...
Yeah, and the basically your big cities are the magnets for these. So they migrate. If a kid runs away, they tend to migrate. They don't run to Coos Bay, they run to Portland.
Right.
And when they get to Portland, they're in a street culture that we're very familiar with. Part of our job of having programs in Vancouver, frankly, is to keep the Vancouver kids from coming to Portland. We used to have 11% of our homeless youth in downtown Portland that were from Vancouver. And those kids are incredibly vulnerable in that system. So we try and keep the services to keep them out, but these are our kids. And anybody could be vulnerable to this. It's like, as soon as you think it's somebody else, you're going to go brain dead on me and we're going to miss it. And part of what I do a lot of workshops and conferences where you see this is a women's issue. You see moms there. You see social workers there. I see a lot of men in this room. I'm going to tell you, this is a men's issue. It's not the women that are buying these guys. It's not the women that are passing the laws that are protecting these guys. We talked about laws we got passed. We passed tougher laws, which I was very excited about. I was in a meeting a couple months ago with the district attorney, and he said, yeah, but the judges aren't enforcing the tough laws. They're not impounding the vehicles, and they're not executing the $10,000 fine that's supposed to be out there.
We need to talk about that. Definitely.
Yeah, so we got to pass the law, but we also got to enforce the laws once they're passed.
My law that I got through judiciary. Representative Parrish.
So I belong to Disruptivist International. They are working on this issue. I know I could share the answer, but I'd like to have you share with the committee what you think is the need in terms of beds for these girls, that they're not enough beds when we're pulling these girls in off the streets. Can you share with the committee what you think that need is? Because at some point, we're going to have to find a way to fund some additional beds. I know Senator Wyden has been actively trying to champion this, some dollars at the federal level, but at some point, the state is going to need to kick in some dollars around beds and housing for this population of girls. And can you share what you think that need is?
I don't have a raw number for you. We designed the system to accommodate about 125 girls annually. Right now, we have shelter capacity. Our emergency shelter capacity is adequate, so we can get anybody who needs safety off the street for that first 2 weeks to a month even. We're safe there. The 7-bed facility we just opened, my anticipation is it'll take a few months to fill up. But frankly, when we did the planning, we planned for 2 7-bed facilities. We believed we needed 14 beds, but we did not want to put 14 of these kids in one place at one time, trust me. You don't want 14 teenage girls in one place at one time, but you definitely don't want 14 of these. The vulnerability was too high, so we looked at 2 14-bed facilities, and I think where I would go now is I think that 14-bed number would be adequate if the other 7 were some kind of a more semi-secure type of a location. And then if we need more, we can add them from there, but I get cautious about overbuilding because these are very expensive programs to operate. Like what we had to do to open a shelter for these kids is we had to double our night staff, so the state ratio would be 1 to 10. We put 2 to 10 on nights because if the pimp shows up, you've got to have somebody there. And then we had to put cameras throughout the whole building, which the staff got upset about, but we said, we're not spying on you, but we need to know when somebody comes in, when somebody goes out, and what's happening inside here. So the cost of the program, to me, says let's incrementally look at it. But I'm sure that we don't have enough now. I don't think we need 20 or 30 or 40, but I think we need, the beds need to come into the plan that we've looked at here. And that would be my estimate. It'll be another probably 7 to 10, but probably in a secure kind of a setting.
Thank you so much, Dennis. We'll be hearing more from you in the future.
Yeah, if you've got Girl Scout cookies, I'll come back anytime. Absolutely.
Now we'll be hearing from Clackamas Women's Services, Jennifer Hopkinson and Kristen Schlotterbeck. Oh, good.
All right. My name is Kristen Schlotterbeck. I'm the Prevention, Education, and Youth Programs Manager, which means that primarily a lot of my job is working with youth and talking with youth. So I've noticed while the other couple of people have spoken that you all have been very interested and very attentive, and I'm worried that that's going to throw me off without questions interrupting me from every angle. So if you have questions as I go along, please ask me questions. I'm happy to talk about our services at length. What you have in front of you is, I wanted to really capture, I think sometimes when a lot of numbers are thrown out, they feel overwhelming and exhausting. And so I really wanted to capture what we do on sort of a smaller level. And so you'll see the sheet in front of you has the statistics of the people that we've served since the beginning of the year, so for the last month and a half, basically. And as you look at those numbers, I would ask you to sort of think about how many people you know and care about in your lives. In our rural program, we serve 23 survivors and their families of domestic violence, and I would assume all of you know 23 people that you love and care about in your lives. So just think of those numbers sort of on a smaller individual level as I go through our services. So first, one of the first services that we offer and that we tell folks about is our 24-hour crisis line. It's one of the few services that we always have available for survivors. We served, I think, almost 200 calls since January, which is actually a fairly low number, if that is surprising to you. Portland Women's Crisis Line in the Tri-County area helps us out a lot, and a lot of calls that would come to us go through them first. So our crisis line, even serving 300 calls, is not ringing off the hook for us. But what we do know is that...
Is that January of this year?
Mm-hmm, January of this year, yes. But luckily that the support from Portland Women's Crisis Line lets us talk more and spend longer on the phones with people, which means that we can provide them sort of in-depth crisis planning, safety planning, and help them through what their other options are. Because right now, I've been at Clackamas Women's Services for about a year and a year and a half now, and since the time that I started with CWS, I have not seen a bed open at any of the Tri-County shelters for more than several hours. That's the usual rate. So that's not only our shelter, but the, I think, four others that are in the Tri-County area has not had spaces open for survivors for more than several hours. So what we're doing on the crisis line is talking with survivors and women about if they can go to 24-hour places that operate for 20 that are open 24 hours, if there are hospitals, airports, places that they can stay to remain safe just in the meantime before going back home to a place that is often violent and scary. In our emergency shelter since January, we served 14 women and 17 children. Currently, we have about 8 spaces open for survivors and their families, usually from single women to women and 5 children. We recently built an annex on our property that will house another 8 spaces for survivors and their families, which means that we'll be doubling capacity very soon. We operate under a very specific rights and responsibilities model, which allows us to have a lot greater flexibility when we work with people. Often we can accept people into our shelter program where they wouldn't be accepted into other shelter programs. So we can house people who have mental or different or physical disabilities. We're also able to house people who have greater language barriers, who have non-traditional families that include adult dependents, or people who have drug use in their past. So we're able to accept all of those into our shelter program. Shelter started as sort of a 30-day stay, but what we know is that 30 days is not enough time for women to be able to get back on their feet, to figure out income, housing, often different safe schools for their kids, as well as try out a little bit of time for emotional healing, and it's just not enough time. So we're granting a lot of extensions right now, especially because in the current economic climate, it makes it even more difficult, and we don't want to be releasing people from our shelter into homelessness. So we're extending stays at our shelter fairly often right now. To sort of address the need of having people access our services and then have nowhere else to go, in 2008 we started the Beyond Shelter Initiative, which helps women and their families. Either they can start in our shelter program and move into our transitional housing program, or just start in our transitional housing program. Through that program, we provide case management to help survivors figure out what they need to do to get housing. A lot of that, it's a very confusing process for most people, and a lot of them have barriers from their credit history or from past experiences in rental apartments where their abuser may have destroyed things, or you name it. There are so many barriers to finding survivors housing, and so we have case managers that work on addressing those things, and we also have good relationships with the apartment complexes in Clackamas County, really good relationships with people who want to help provide safe places for our survivors, so we can often move them into one of those programs, and we provide rental assistance and other safety planning information and referral for survivors and their children through that program. We also, through that program, we believe very strongly in having wraparound services that assist both the survivor and their families. So clients in our transitional housing program can also access our legal advocacy programs and our counseling and support group programs so that they get sort of a whole safety net of services. Our legal program Our legal advocate helps file restraining orders and stalking orders. What we know is that the courthouse is a very intimidating setting, especially if you're bringing along a couple of kids, and the courthouse in Clackamas County doesn't have child care. We also deal with a lot of survivors who have language barriers, and that's an issue for them as well. So having someone that can really follow through that process with them is enormously helpful to their healing. A lot of times what we see in the courthouse is that the abuser is either released from jail for the first time, and that's the first time that the survivor has to see him again, or that the abuser shows up with every neighbor that they know and their entire family, and the survivor is left alone. So having a legal advocate that can accompany the survivor to the courthouse is amazingly helpful to them. We also recently...
Go ahead. 14 of these in the last maybe six and a half weeks, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 14 restraining orders filed, and 17 were just information referral. Yeah, yeah.
A lot. Thank you.
Yeah, what we know, that most of the reason for the discrepancy in those numbers is that what we know is that even though the restraining orders are there to keep people safe, sometimes it's just a piece of paper, and going through that process may, in fact, make the abuser more upset and more dangerous. And so having the legal advocate that can really safety plan with someone beforehand about whether that's a right decision for them can also be helpful for their safety as well. We also recently started a lethality assessment program in combination with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, which has been enormously successful so far. What happens is that when someone from the Sheriff's Office goes on a domestic violence house call, they go through a series of questions with the survivor there, and if the survivor screams in, they're put right on the phone with our crisis line, both so that we can talk to the officer in the situation and the survivor. So immediately they have some connection with us to provide them services and to try to get them some safety planning and support that they might need. We also recently received funding to begin a rural program, which means that we have a rural advocate, a rural coordinator, and rural counselor, and rural prevention education specialist that we've recently hired. So we've been providing services out in the rural area since October. We're just starting up, and we have experienced so much support in the rural areas that we help. A lot of people out there have transportation barriers. Not a lot of services are available to them. And the isolation is huge for people in those rural areas, that they are not able to even get into the city for help or assistance, and no one knows that they're out there and that they need help. And then we provide counseling and support groups. We have three counselors on our staff, one youth counselor. All of them can provide family counseling if that's something that the survivor wants. Luckily, our counseling program is very, very flexible, so we're not limited by insurance companies how many sessions a client wants. It's really up to them to decide. And we also operate three, almost four, support groups, one of which is Spanish-speaking. Mm-hmm. And then finally, our prevention, education, and youth programs works on the sort of the other side, the primary prevention side. So we have a male prevention education specialist who goes and talks to elementary-age boys. He runs boys groups that are 8 to 10 weeks long. In those boys groups, they talk about toughness, what healthy masculinity means, trying to address conflicts without violence. We also do presentations in the middle schools and high schools about domestic violence, dating violence, sexual violence, and stalking. We're piloting a new survey right now along with our presentations to try to really gather some statistics about how often this type of violence is affecting youth in our community. Those statistics aren't being recorded anywhere else as far as we know. And so within, we recently surveyed 240 students, 25% of which were currently living in a household with domestic violence. Of those, 75% of youth witnessed or identified that it was emotional abuse, 17 indicated that the abuse was physical in nature, and 11 sexual in nature, which is just heartbreaking when we think that people are that our youth are knowing that their parents are experiencing sexual abuse. It's heartbreaking.
Kristen, we're going to have to move along.
Sorry, go ahead.
Did you have a...
I was just going to share a story about a survivor.
Okay, we're going to ask you because we've got more presentations and we've only got
a little bit over an hour.
Sorry. That would be fine. Thank you. Go ahead. Very quickly.
Okay. So this is one family that I had worked with. Was severely sexually and physically abused as a kid.
Oh, your name, please.
Oh, my name is Jennifer Hopkinson.
Thank you, Jennifer.
I'm the counseling and support group program manager. I also act as a counselor, do counseling with families. And mom was, very vulnerable when she was young. She didn't have much formal education. Her father had kept her pretty much locked in a room most of her young life. She married young, and her husband turned out to be abusive as well. She had a couple of children, and when she was pregnant with her third child, she had sort of endured most of the abuse, and this was something she learned to do. She was, knew how to survive. But she became pregnant with this third child, and she was gone one day to the grocery store with her daughter. And when she came home, she learned that her son had been thrown across the room, that the abuse had turned on the kids. And at that point, she made a decision. And she didn't want to give anything away. She was assaulted that night, but she told me specifically she didn't resist because she didn't want him to suspect. And the next day, as soon as he was gone out of the house, she got the kids, and they grabbed what they could carry, and they left. And they went into our shelter. And at the shelter, they have 24-hour case management, and she started to do groups there, too. She did some of the support groups, and she started to realize that everything that she'd been through was abuse, that it wasn't just the extreme examples of physical abuse and sexual abuse, that all the emotional abuse, everything that she had come to believe about herself was part of that cycle. Mm-hmm. And she was able to get into one of our housing programs that we have a partnership with the county, Shelter Plus Care, because she was on disability. Her disability because of the abuse was so severe that she qualified for that. So she got into housing, and when the family first moved in, they put all the mattresses together in the floor in the center of the largest room, and that was how they slept for the first few months. And I've seen a lot of families do that. They are so scared, and they need to see eyes on each other. They need to know that the other family members are okay. So they did that for a while, and it was at this point that I met them. I started doing counseling with them. The daughter was 12 years old. She was cutting. She was suicidal. The boy was acting out. He was having trouble making friends because he was aggressive. We worked together. We did family counseling. Did counseling with mom for a long time. Daughter does not cut anymore. She is not suicidal anymore. And the boy is starting to make friends. And mom is doing very well. And that was from the beginning to the present. It was a really positive experience for the whole family to be able to get that support and be safe.
That's great. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Colleagues, we're not going to take time for questions because we have several more presentations.
Thank
you. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
And so, pardon?
Luke.
Oh, hello. Thank you. Nicole and Matt, if you could come this direction, please. And while they're walking up here, I will introduce them as let me just say that over the years, I've gotten a chance to see programs for the Native American folks in Portland and around the city, especially in Portland, though. And a significant change took place. And that change took place at NIA when Nicole arrived. And she made a huge difference and has created a sustainable program, I think, that will be helping folks there. You have a little thing that talks about the invisible community here, and she probably will talk about that. But I wanted to say, first of all, I thank her publicly. for all the work she's done. It's been extraordinary work. And Matt, thank you. And Matt is now on the Portland School Board. And he is executive. What are you on the chair of the board there too?
The deputy executive director.
Deputy executive director there. This has made a huge difference for the Native American community, and I'm going to let them brag a little bit more. So
great.
Go ahead.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having us this afternoon. I'll start with a traditional greeting, Kalhayam Katamaika, Kanawe Naika Tilakam, Gunas Chish. So I just greeted and welcomed you in the land of the Chinook, which is where we are today, and thanked you in my own language. I'm an enrolled member of the Tlingit and Haida Central Council, which we have about 3,000 enrolled members that live in the state of Oregon, even though we are originally from Southeast Alaska. It's my pleasure to be here with you today. I've had the honor of serving.
Interrupt you just for a second.
Sure.
You need to identify yourself for the record. Mm-hmm. And these crazy microphones are a little sensitive. Just, you can either move yourself back or push it away from you.
Oh.
And we're looking forward to your testimony.
Great. Thank you for the additional coaching. My name is Nicole Maher. So it's my honor to talk to you a little bit today about the Native Community of Portland and NAIA Family Center. I have had the honor of serving as the executive director for a little over 10 years, and it's been a real blessing to really observe our community, really begin to identify solutions and implement them and start to see some really positive outcomes for our young people. Many folks are not aware that about 70% of the entire Native population in the state of Oregon actually lives within Multnomah County. Within Multnomah County, we have about 40,000 Native Americans. And while we have significant percentages of the Oregon tribes who live in Portland, we also have vast diversity from around the country. Portland was one of seven relocation sites that saw literally tens of thousands of Native folks relocated there over about a 40-year period from 1950 until the late 1980s. And because of that, we have significant diversity with almost 400 tribes that call the Multnomah County their home. NAIA Family Center was founded in the early 1970s to really meet the needs of the urban Native community. Today, we're a little bit different than we were in those beginning years. We have about 100 employees. We operate about an $8 million budget. And we're a pretty unique organization in that our services are designed to really meet the community's needs in a very culturally specific manner. One of the things that we know about our community is that while we're one of the largest and most diverse communities and we have many strengths, we also suffer a very deep burden when it comes to equal access to services, poverty, and successful educational attainment. So, for example, while one out of every 14 white children lives in poverty in Multnomah County, which is entirely too high, one out of every two Native children lives in poverty. Only 3 out of every 10 students graduates high school in a 4-year time period in Multnomah County, and that's actually one of the highest graduation rates we've ever had as a community. And so we have a long way to go. The other challenge that we face is, though, while we have extraordinary need, which is, you know, sort of documented in every piece of data that you'll look at, our community continually is left out of services and opportunity. So while we have the greatest poverty and we're the most overrepresented ethnic group in homelessness, we're actually the least likely group to receive low-income housing. We're the least likely group to be part of TANF. We're almost 30% of all children in foster care, but when you look at any of the preventive services or opportunities to help families stay together, we're one of the communities that's the least likely to be served. And so we have a lot of needs that, even though we pay taxes and are a contributing member of our community, we haven't had that equal access. And so the way that NAIA has been founded and organized our services is really, rather than organizing the services on what's best for the service provider, it's really what's best for the community. And so we have created a comprehensive array of services in our Northeast Portland location where a family can come and receive comprehensive domestic violence services, comprehensive housing options all the way from homelessness to home ownership. We founded our own high school, and we have comprehensive after-school programs, family and parenting education, as well as a host of foster care parenting classes, and I'm just sharing a few samples. We've had some really proud moments in the last several years. Last year, we celebrated helping over 700 people find jobs, and we had an average increase of income by 25%, which we were very pleased with. And these are many folks who have struggled finding employment for many, many years. We celebrated our 115th new homeowner in the Native community without a single family going into foreclosure, and assisted our community in leveraging over $22 million in lending to the Native community, which was very exciting. Our domestic violence program was successful in gaining women in shelter up to 30 days, which is an indicator of safety. And we are also fortunate to own and operate low-income housing, and we were pleased to put aside 10% of our housing for survivors of domestic violence so that they could have permanent supportive housing. We were also very pleased in 2008, the Gates Foundation chose one educational organization in the country to honor for outstanding outcomes, and NAIA Family Center was that organization for our after-school tutoring program. And the school that I mentioned earlier that we opened in 2006, this year will be in our fifth year. And our last 2 years, we celebrated an 88% graduation rate with 100% of our graduating seniors going on to college. And these are students who have historically struggled. And I think what this tells you is that our students and our families want to be successful. They want opportunity. And if they're given the right support and the right opportunity, they will succeed, and that the Native community is an opportunity for the entire state of Oregon. For far too long, our community has been viewed as a burden, as a challenge, as having too many problems to even think about where we might be able to make an impact. And I think what we have seen as a community is that when our community is invited to the table to help define what the solutions are, we can be incredibly successful. The last thing I would just mention, since the theme of today is really partnering with nonprofits, is that we have, you know, incredibly challenging times around us. But I think our organization and many other nonprofits are really a fine example about how partnerships and leveraging can create immense opportunity for our entire state. For example, NAIA Family Center, while we're a Native American organization, we actually don't receive any resources from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We don't receive any specific set-aside resources for being a Native program because we're a nonprofit. We're not a tribe, so we're not actually eligible for any of those resources. But with the investments that we've received from the state, from the county, we've been able to leverage tens of millions of dollars from foundations, from being able to compete in federal applications. And over the last 10 years, we've brought almost $50 million to the state of Oregon in outside funding streams that have served not only our children and families, but created jobs in the community and brought a real benefit to our local economy. And I think so often when we think about nonprofits, we really recognize and honor them for the social services that they bring, and that's very, very important. But we are bringing a whole host of other opportunities for the entire state. So I'll leave you with that. I wanted to give Mr. Matt Morton, who is a member of the Squaxin Island Tribe, a moment to speak and then allow you to ask us questions. I know you're on a timeline, so I want to respect that.
I really just came for the Girl Scout cookies. But thank you, Nicole. My name is Matt Morton. I'm from the Squaxin Island Tribe, and I have the pleasure of working at the NAIA Family Center as the Deputy Executive Director. And as Representative Frederick mentioned, I also have the privilege of serving on the Portland School Board. The educational outcomes that Nicole mentioned are the kinds of things that we're trying to learn within our school district. Not only those outcomes that the NAIA Family Center gets, but I know Tony Hobson from SEI will be coming up and speaking about his program. Those are the kinds of lessons that we're working on learning within our district and serving those kids of color and those kids that are the most at risk. The one thing I want to mention, and I love sitting here and listening to Nicole speak about the great things that the NAIA Family Center has done, and the one theme that runs through my mind is with any iota, any ounce of opportunity, the Native community thrives. And sometimes it looks different than what we see in majority culture or in other programs, but they absolutely thrive. And we can see that through the educational outcomes. We can see that through the economic outcomes, housing, and so on and so on. So I really appreciate the opportunity to be here before you and for this organization to present this information.
Thank you so much. Can you tell us how many children are in your school?
Sure. We have a little less than 120 students in our high school, and then we support about 800 students in our after-school programs with case management, advocacy, tutoring, and kind of sports, culture, and recreation. So our school is small.
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. I got a chance to tour the school, had a great conversation with a number of students there, got a big kick out of it. Obviously, I think Nicole knows about that. But if you get a chance, it's up on Columbia Boulevard, 650.
Yeah, right above 42nd.
42nd, yeah. Somewhere just past 42nd or so on Columbia Boulevard, north side. And it is the old Columbia, it's the old
Whitaker Lake site.
Whitaker school site,
oh, yeah.
That has lakes and ponds behind it. It's a beautiful site, but they have transformed it into an excellent program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Frederick, I may add, is the only person we've ever taken on a tour that stopped and started actually doing microscope tutoring with the students in the classroom. So, and my science teacher did confirm that he was instructing them correctly.
Any quick questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What one or two really significant factors can you cite about the success, contributing to the success of this high school?
Sure. I think that our community views the success and the challenges of our students as their own challenge. And so, you know, for years we had been advocating for change and reform, and we will always do that, and we will always be part of the larger solution, because certainly that's where the majority of Native kids are. But I think when our community said, you know, really no one's going to come and rescue our kids unless we do it for ourselves, that made a huge difference. And I think that the message that we give to our young people every single day, that we need them, they're important, they're our future leaders, they're valued and that they're wanted, and that all of our staff members and our elders and our volunteers are intentionally sort of trained to give that message to them, really makes a difference. That's what will make a student ride a bus for an hour and 15 minutes a day to come to school. That's what will have a young mother, you know, pack up her baby and bring the kid to school because she wants to come to school so bad. I think those two things, I mean, I think we have great teachers, great academics, but I think that sense of belonging that our young people feel is what really makes that change. And when they begin to celebrate their native heritage and identity and feel very proud of that, you see them improve in so many other ways.
I have two other answers.
I hope they match mine.
No, I would say in addition, engaging curriculum that the kids see themselves in, and then culturally specific wraparound services. Mm-hmm. When you're able to reach students and their families in the places where they're at, you're able to get better results.
Okay, thanks.
And someday I'd like to talk with you about, I know that you have a higher number of children in foster care, and offline, I'd like to talk with you about that, but I didn't know about the low number of TANF. So offline, maybe you could leave the information on how I could contact you. I'd like to talk with you about that. Thank you both for coming. I really appreciate that very much.
Yeah, thanks.
And next, we're going to have Tony Hobson from Self Enhancement.
Tony, several people on this panel could have introduced you.
You are well known and well liked, and we're eager to hear what's going on with SEN.
Oh, wonderful. Well, Chair Tolman and Chair Gillen, appreciate the opportunity. My name for the record is Tony Hobson, Sr., President and CEO of Self Enhancement Inc., youth development program, multi-service organization in Portland, Oregon, with a very successful replication in Miami, Florida, of all places. I appreciate having the opportunity to share this afternoon. And what I'll try to do is I will talk about self-enhancement, but I also want to talk a little bit about the bigger picture and why I think what we're talking about today is important. Nonprofit organizations and their role in a lot of the work that we all are attempting to do. At a time when we're confronted with a declining revenue and budget cuts, but at the same time seeing a true increase in the need for health care, social services, and education, we cannot and will not be able to sustain any level of quality services if we don't somehow fully partner with the nonprofit community. The direction should be, in my opinion, a public-private partnership between public entities and quality proven nonprofits, and I want to underscore quality proven nonprofits. In many cases, our federal and state funded entities, be it again in healthcare organizations, be it DHS and county social services or local school districts, oftentimes really don't have the community trust, don't have the nimbleness to move quickly, don't have the relationships necessary to help children and families in a timely manner. And to me, that causes massive issues when we're dealing with bureaucracies that stumble their way through trying to get services to children and families in a timely manner. Not too long ago, we had a senior graduate from Jefferson High School and graduate from our SEI program, and celebrating the following week in the park with her family, and became the victim of a drive-by shooting just in the park having a good time. There was no services that the government could have provided or Multnomah County could have provided or the city could have provided that would be able to immediately step into that situation and deal with that particular family around that issue and deal with the community that was up in arms. Some of you not too long ago might have witnessed on TV at a late night show news brief that outlined a police shooting in a household where there were three kids in the house. All three of them were SEI children. They were upstairs. And what was interesting about this, we saw on the news an adult going upstairs and taking the kids through a window to take them outside so they did not have to walk by the body downstairs. There was no government entities ready to step into that situation that night. That was SEI stepping into that situation that night, working with those kids, finding a place for them to be, and dealing with all of the circumstances that they were confronted with. On the other end, I could talk about a Jefferson High School, the only predominantly African-American high school in the entire state of Oregon, being threatened for closure. And the fact that through self-enhancement, we were able to rally an entire community around that effort and keep that school open. To a large degree now, that school is doing much better. I'll talk a little bit later about how well it is doing. Then lastly, we could talk about a number of young people who come through our program. They're the first ones to go to college in their families, but struggle at the college site, and who do they call? They call self-enhancement. Why? Because there's no one in their families that ever been to college, so they don't know who else to call. And many of them couldn't even get there and wouldn't have a shot at it without the resources that we provide for them in terms of scholarship and support services and taking them through all of the bureaucracy just to get there. There are examples of things that happen, examples like this that happen every day. People's lives are on the line. We just don't have time to discuss whose department is responsible. By the year 2023, minority youth in America will become the majority youth in America. By 2040, minority adults will become the majority adults in America. Now, we are all aware of what the data shows about the achievement gap with poor children, children of color, In fact, we know that every 26 seconds, another kid drops out of school. We're all aware of the overrepresentation that's been talked about of people in color in both the juvenile and the criminal justice system. We consistently see the disparities of services of people of color in our health care system. But in all of these areas of service across our great state, most of these services are led, operated, and serviced by largely white Americans. The cultural competency and the cultural specificity is not there and won't be there in time to deal with the future needs of an ever-changing population. I believe that the only hope we have in our state and nation, for that matter, in serving the future demographics of our population is our ability to work with nonprofits who can be the bridge between government and state-run organizations and our hundreds of thousands of people in need that are really still on the ground. So SEI has been on the ground doing this work for over 30 years. We are by far, in my opinion, one of the most comprehensive, successful youth development, multi-service organizations servicing kids of color this state has ever seen. Actually, 90% of the kids that come into our program have either attendance, behavior, or academic problems. They get referred to us via teachers, counselors, and administrators in their individual schools. We actually start with kids at age 8. We follow those kids all the way through to age 25. We provide in-school services, we provide summer services, after-school services, and we do what we call the culture of success, which actually develops for each kid an ISP, which stands for an individual success plan. And we actually put our last name on every kid. Some people say, well, what does that mean? So everything that you would do for your own son or daughter, if you're really willing to do that for every single kid that comes through the door, then you can have the kind of success that we have. We service over 1,300 core kids in our program that are case managed every day. We serve another 1,700 kids through the Sun School system, which is Sun Schools Uniting Neighborhoods. And we have about 5 or 6 of those schools in 1,700 total, and another 5,000 families that we touch every day in some of the social services that we provide. We graduate, 98% of the kids that come into our program graduate from high school, 85% go on to college. Now, to me, before you even ask the question, why do we have that success? To me, we have researched this into the ground, and we continue to research it, but I would tell you, the success and the reason why we have it is because we refuse to let a kid fail. I can tell you the biggest difference between kids who make it and don't make it is the support services around them. If a kid falls, who is there to pick them up? Who is there to catch them? Who is there to tell them that I love you, you're okay, push them back in the game and support them through a process to keep going? Certainly we need stronger teachers. Certainly we need better leadership. Certainly we need robust curriculum. But none of that works for Jamal if he's coming from a broken home and an environment to where he doesn't even know whether or not he's going to eat the next day. So those are the things that self-enhancement does for every kid and every family that comes into our program. We partner with Multnomah County to provide family and student support services. We partner with DHS to help keep families together. We partner with City of Portland to provide after-school services and serve foster care students. We partner with Portland Public Schools to help attack the achievement gap, graduation rates, and college entrance. One of the major pieces that we presently embarked on 2 years ago was the whole school model, where we took on the entire freshman class at Jefferson High School. This year we're in that second year, so we have the freshman and sophomore class. Over the next couple years, we'll end up servicing over 80% of all the students in Jefferson High School. Now, for those of you who don't know, Jefferson has not been the most academically oriented place based on the outcomes that the school has gotten. In fact, they only graduate somewhere between 45 and 48% of the kids. We expect 2 years from now to have a graduation rate of 80%. Some people think we're crazy. We think that we can get that done. So now you move from a point of turning individual kids around to being able to turn an entire school around. And we hope that that will be noteworthy enough that the resources would follow. So what we have proven is that for every $1 given to SEI, we return $9 of service and savings to the state of Oregon. We bring some $5 million a year of private resources to the table. We have 115 full-time staff, 150 part-time staff. That makes us one of the largest black-owned and operated agencies in the state with an overall budget of $12 million. So as the governor talks about the 40-40-20 plan, that means all kids will be rising at a level not yet experienced in this state or in the nation. So it's quite a goal to put out there. Today I'm here to tell you, in order for that to happen, an intentional effort of public-private partnership that allows quality, proven nonprofits to have a full-funded role in the delivery system of health care, social services, and most certainly education, and that must be implemented. The proven program must be first identified and then scaled up to have greater impact on a larger number of kids and families. Our choice is simple. You can pay me now or pay me later. We can pay in the front end and change lives and enhance opportunities, or we can pay on the back end and try to rehabilitate a life at a much higher cost in a prison system that we fund at a higher level than college. My famous last words will always continue to be, we do not have a youth problem in America. We have an adult problem in America. Kids learn not based on what we say, but what they see us do. All they're waiting for is for us to do the right thing. Thank you. I'll take questions.
Thank you. I'll open it up in a second, but I just, you know, I'm very appreciative of Multnomah County partnering with you. I'm very appreciative of DHS, so this is not to denigrate those wonderful government entities, but the thing that resonates with me is when you say, in time of crisis, in the kind of situations that you describe, there isn't a government agency ready to step in at that situation. And you all are, and I appreciate it very much. I absolutely believe we need to take what you're doing to a larger scale, but thank goodness for what you're doing, where you're doing it. I appreciate it. Are there other comments or questions from our...
Well, I have to say something because SEI is in my district, and I have known Tony since I was a reporter, and when they were working out of a storefront on Broadway, where I did the first interviews about SEI back then, and the dream that he had of basically putting this wraparound program together then has come true. It is something that is clearly effective. We need to recognize that we are talking about really wrapping our arms around the families of these kids and around the community of those of the kids. That's why they're successful. That's one of the reasons they're successful, and the tenacity that this guy has about making sure that this is done. So I am really pleased to see this, and he has managed to bring about a renaissance right now, and I think we're going to see a real change in the next few years by way of SEI and the involvement in the community.
Here, here. Representative Parrish.
I just want to thank you for bringing this, and really everybody who's here today. I mean, we've had this discussion before about we got these nonprofits that just dig for money under the couch cushions, do a whole lot with a whole lot of nothing, and yet the results are dramatic, and they make this huge impact. And I just continue to want to thank the chairs for bringing days like this so we can see and hear what good partners the nonprofits are and find, you know, ways down the road as we look at funding, how to get more dollars to frontline to organizations like yours that are doing, you know, this work. And really, it is truly from a goodness of your heart perspective, because you're not getting paid a lot to go do this kind of stuff, that we find ways to continue to make sure that you are all successful doing your role. And I think we have some obligation to continue to find ways to fund organizations and get dollars. If we're not already giving you dollars, how do we find ways to get dollars into your hands from the state level? Because certainly the delivery model for what everybody in here is talking about today is, you know, these are better, cheaper, smarter, faster, and they're doing a good job with the few bucks that they have. And just got to give it to you that you are here today sharing your story and that you go back in your community and continue to do good work.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. I appreciate that. And that's part of the reason why we're all down here, is that as we go through the conversations down here and as we have opportunities to talk to the governor and others, part of this has to be put into plan as we're making those decisions and that not after the fact. So we appreciate to have an opportunity.
Representative Widener, and then we'll move to the next group, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, Tony, the one thing that you kind of hit me when you were speaking was that you love the kids. Yeah. That's what makes the difference. Yeah. And a government agency doesn't know how to do that and can never achieve that. And I think that's the thing you notice with that great coach who makes a difference in a child's life. Right. He truly cares about the kids and the individuals. Right. This is why government can never achieve what you're doing and why we have to look for nonprofits and people who care. Because it's communities coming together. Right. You know, and that's the biggest thing. And look, because I live in a community where the average income is about $42,000.
Yeah.
But when the community unites and works together, you get great things done for our children. So, and that's what I appreciated you bringing up more than anything, is the fact that it's being done with love above all else. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tony. Next presenter is Doreen Kelly from Silverton Together. Funny how this worked out, colleagues, but you're going to see why this organization is aptly named when she gives her presentation. From Silverton Together, Doreen, please.
Thank you, representatives, co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei, and representatives from the committee. It is with great honor that we come here today. We're very pleased to present to you the programs and services that our organization offers to our community. My name is Doreen Kelly, and I live in Silverton, Oregon, and I am the program manager for Silverton Together. And with me today is our president of the board, Ken Hector, who is also the community outreach and government affairs director for Silverton Health. Silverton Together's mission is to work collaboratively to promote the health and well-being of all our children, families, and community. And it's really critical to understand we're a nonprofit that's very small. We're a community progress team, yet we're able to be relatively prolific with the services and programs we offer because of all the collaborations we have and the partnerships with area businesses, churches, nonprofits, and government agencies. So that all comes into it. Our governing board is comprised of leaders from all the different areas of our community, such as government, education, health, law enforcement, faith, business, and agriculture. And this gives our organization the ability to be able to evaluate our community's needs as a whole and swiftly implement any type of programs that may come about from these needs. We also have a substantial pool of incredible expertise to assist us in the governance and provision of our services. Now, we were incorporated in 1993 as one of the Oregon Together communities. And we got together to look at problematic youth behaviors. And when we did so, the leaders and frontline service providers conducted considerable research to identify the risk and protective factors for our children. It became evident to all of us that to have the optimal effect on youth, we must start early. We would need to start with the parents and with the family unit. And we identified three risk factors that we believe that our community could address and that were critical. These were poor family management, social isolation, and the lack of resources. So those were the three critical areas that we looked to resolve. Parent education was recognized as one of the pivotal methods for us to be able to address the issue of poor family management. And it's primarily a preventive tool geared at parents of children ages 0 to 8 years of age. And within the package you have, you'll see there's a list of our classes and a schedule. And we are the most, we have the most extensive list of parenting education classes throughout the county. In fact, we get calls from Salem area groups to try to implement that for them as well. We're very proud of our classes, and they're all research-based, multi-session classes that we started in 1995. We now offer 9 different parent education classes, and they're designed for parents with children of varying ages. We're fortunate to have several bilingual Spanish and Russian instructors as well that enable us to provide the classes in those sectors of our community. Now, the classes are designed for what we call the universal parent, meaning all parents, because everyone needs this kind of assistance. The classes help parents understand the various developmental stages of their children, some age-appropriate activities that are important to do to ensure the success of their children in school and later in life. We look at making sure our instructors receive professional training and that they're able to connect with the parents in the group. We conduct surveys at the end of every class, and last year, 100% of the parents who participated in the classes reported gains in parenting skills and would recommend the classes to their friends. Now, another outcome, though, from these classes is the creation of a parent peer support system. And this is very critical, especially for people who are just getting involved in having children and realize that there's so much to raising children, and you're often isolated those first years. So having other families that you can connect with, start developing bonds, makes it much easier transition. And we see that the families in our classes will do this. And they'll continue to have activities outside of our classes. And in fact, the people who took the first Birth to Three series 3 years in 1996 are still friends today. So it's a testament to the long-lasting impact of these classes. And we have that information as well in our materials. Now, Silverton also together created an indoor park as another way for parents to get together on a regular basis. And it's run by the parents. It's a co-op. And it's for those who have children 0 to 5 years of age. And that continues to run to this day. And we partner with them still on many activities. In another effort to address social isolation, we created many events. We have these, they're on an annual basis, and we take surveys at each one to determine if these events actually serve their purpose. Do they help community members feel more connected? And we get a 90% average have said yes, these events in themselves do make them feel more connected to the community. They're free, family-oriented, and are implemented with the aid of many community partners. And that's really key, because what I haven't mentioned yet is that we have a staff of 1.3 FTE and an annual budget of $110,000 a year. So so if you keep that in mind when hearing about all these different activities that we have. We also started this year the Read Across America Day. We're participating in that. We'd like to invite all of you to attend. We included a flyer, and you can see we involved all of the schools, elementary schools, K through 3. We provided free Dr. Seuss books, and each classroom is going to have some type of activity revolving around literacy. The library is also teaming up with us and doing a special event. And then the downtown merchants are going to incorporate literacy into the First Friday activities that evening. So we kind of approach these things from a multi-prong level when we're doing it. Now, one of the things that you'll see is our parent and family support program that we have, and it was created to help eliminate some of those barriers to success that are attributable to lack of resources. One of the things we do in your packet, you'll see a large community event calendar and resource guide. We produce those 3 times a year, and it goes out to about 2,500 families. So we give those out to the schools, the library, many different places. Our partners are invited to submit information free of charge and also contribute to the resource section so that we can better inform all of our parents of these wonderful resources. We produce smaller guides such as the one for social services, local child care resources, domestic violence, and youth links that address those specific needs. Now, we also conduct many drives throughout the year, and they involve children in all of them. We have the Tree of Giving that helps about 600 kids each year, Coats for Kids Drive, 12,000 books in 12 days, and the Apple Tree School Supplies Drive. And that one is probably one of our premier programs. We work with children ages 9 through 17, and they work on this intensive 3-month program to gather enough supplies to help children in need in the school district. They work up to 140 hours, each of them. It's pretty amazing. They are asked to take on considerable responsibility. They're treated as adults. And we have about 50 businesses that also participate. So it is a huge undertaking. And the results have been great. Some of our kids have gone on to be the future First Citizen. They've served on the State Education Board, Youth Advisory Committee, and many other accomplishments in student leadership as well.
We said we have. Can I ask a question?
Please.
Yes.
This is amazing. I think you've been before us other times, and it is amazing. But I wrote down a figure that I can't believe is true, and I can't see it. Your budget is $110,000 a year, and how many people did you say you employ?
1.3. I'm the one, and our instructors for the parent education program, their total hours amount to about 0.3 FTE.
And you do all of this on 1.3 FTE.
Again, it's
the loaves and fishes. Is that what we're thinking about, the parable of the loaves and fishes?
Oh, exactly.
Amazing. Thank you. I'm sorry to
interrupt. No, please feel free to ask any questions. I think that what is key, and when Representative Gilliam asked us to appear today, it's our partnerships that enable us to do these things. And we have an incredible board of directors that also lend us support. When you look at that figure, $110,000, what's not included in that is all of the free support we get from the Silverton Health, the school district, the city of Silverton. We pay $0 for our offices and parent education classrooms and our utilities, except for the phone and internet. So we are able to coordinate these efforts based on available resources that the community has to offer, and in turn we help each other with different aspects of community need. In order to be able to provide these services, we found that it was important to establish a committee to look at coordinating all the services. So Silverton Together is the facilitator for a monthly services coordinating committee, and we have representatives from all levels, churches, nonprofits, state, county agencies, that get together, and it is very upfront. Everybody talks about what is needed, what they may have to share, and we develop partnerships on the spot. That group is also part of a email notification network that we're able to pass on resources for grants, job opportunities, program delivery, and other things that come up. And we've been doing that for over 11 years. And I think that also helps establish that connectivity that we need in our community. Silverton Together serves as a trusted point of contact. And I think this is key for a lot of small communities. Many families do not necessarily know which agency to go for or if they even exist. So they'll often come to churches or community groups and let us know about their situations. And then we try to help them make those appropriate referrals. So, you know, we see these great programs out there, but there's often a disconnect between agencies and between agencies in the community, and that's part of our role, is to help people understand what is available. So within our services, you know, last year we helped over 8,000 community members and agencies receive different resources. For community members, we connected them to medical, dental, counseling, food, protective services, education, language acquisition, and many other needs. There really is no area that we probably haven't covered. You know, listening tonight, domestic violence is a big one. We've even had situations for trafficking. So we, you know, we may be small, but we'll see a sampling of all the issues that are involved in our world. Other agencies rely on us to help them connect to the public, especially since we have a lot of contacts within the Hispanic and the Russian Old Believer communities, which are fairly sizable in our area. We have staff members who are bicultural, bilingual, you know, of our instructors, and I speak a little bit of Spanish myself, so we have a lot of families that will come to us and agencies that reach us out to us to help them get their programs rolled out to these communities. We've also helped many of the agencies and nonprofits get free office space. WIC is one, Community Action Agency, our food bank, the YMCA, Easter Seals, and so forth. We help connect them with the city and make arrangements to find them places to establish at no cost, or sorry, $1 a year. So we see that there's a continual need for that, and you'll see that when we talk about the economic downturn, this is an area that has probably impacted us the greatest. We're seeing that a lot of these agencies, when they're having their cuts and program and staff reductions, they've been calling us to see if there's any way we can help them implement those services out in our community. And we do the best we can, but then we remind them that there's one staff person. But we see that there is a huge reliance on our organization to provide these services. We're also seeing more families that, a very substantial number, who had previously been financially stable but no longer are due to the financial, the economic downturn. For Silverton Together, we have managed to sustain our programs over the years despite the decreases in funding from grants and our subsequent staff reductions. This has been due to sound financial planning by the Board of Directors, increased community support, and optimized use of resources. We continue to receive vital support from many of our partners, and the numbers for our events and activities continue to increase. For every dollar that we bring in, we receive $2 to $3 of in-kind support. When Marion County Children and Families Commission did some research about the monies that they gave to community progress teams, the average for their match was, for every dollar they gave, it was a $12 match. Silverton Together's number was 44. So we believe we're highly efficient with the donors' dollars, and we will continue to find ways to fulfill our mission through any other avenues we can find in partnering. Do you have any questions?
Polly, any questions for Doreen? Back to Representative Parrish's point, you really are a great example of our boots on the ground in so many areas where we have so much to do and very little funding. I'm so pleased Representative Tomei brought up the fact that what you do with so little, and that figure you just gave on the in-kind part is part of it, and then you already alluded to it, but I'll repeat it here. It's folks like Ken, who's with you, who is probably the superstar of volunteers in the area, but it takes folks pitching in to coordinate all these, and it's always as impresses me for Silverton. I'm sure everybody here has got folks in their communities that do this sort of thing. I'm just so pleased you do it under the umbrella that you do, and I really want to find ways to encourage DHS, as one example, to, in this time, reach out to folks like you who are, to Tony's point, who are proven, who are quality, and who can provide services. So I am so grateful that you came over. If there's no other comment or question, anything else before you sign off, Doreen, you okay?
No, I'd just like to thank you again for this wonderful opportunity.
Great. Thank you very much. And we have one more, colleagues. And I want to ask Sherry Stock to come up. I've been involved with the Brain Injury Association for some time. And I'm lucky enough to have her as a constituent, but it's very important to realize this organization's having a great effect on all of Oregon, and in awareness and in training and in therapy for folks with brain injuries, as well as the Northwest. She puts on a very vibrant conference every year. My good friend Representative Greenlick has spoken there in the past, and we're glad you're here. Now, here's the thing. She's going to give us a taste of what they do. But the good news is we'll have her back, and I shall let you tell them what kind of training we're going to do, but we're going to have her back during the interim, and I think you'll find this very interesting, colleagues. Sherry, welcome.
So, co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei, and committee members. My name is Sherry Stock. I'm the executive director of the Brain Injury Association. Now it's the Alliance of Oregon, and we're now a member of the United States Brain Injury Alliance. And I'm impressed with all these nonprofits that have presented. We do work with a number of nonprofit groups and state government. We do extensive work with the military. The number one, the signature injury of the returning, the Afghan and Iraqi war is a brain injury. And so we work extensively and very closely with the Oregon VA and the Fort Lewis TBI unit. In fact, they close down the TBI unit to come to our conference. Every single one of them is there. You're getting the newsletter, and in the newsletter you'll see nothing is done in a vacuum. Nothing is done in a vacuum. We work very closely with different government agencies, state agencies primarily. We also work very, very closely with the Centers for Independent Living, nonprofits that are statewide that are peer-run and people with disabilities helping people with disabilities. In here are a couple things about brain injury and symptoms. I don't have time enough to go over it. We have a card that we've made out for people with the brain injury to carry because they have so many issues. With a brain injury, you could have vision issues, you could lose your hearing, you could lose your vision. 60% of all spinal cord injuries also have a brain injury. Brain injury is huge, and it's the last thing on your mind until it's the only thing on your mind. It can affect a child. My oldest son was 3 months old when we were hit by a drunk driver. He's at an 18-month-old level now. He never went through the terrible twos, and he's potty trained, so there's good and bad and everything. But to prevent a brain injury, it's wearing a helmet. And so I was fortunate enough to read the Oregonian and see that Joey Harrington was hit in July by a car and... very sad. He was hit by a car in Portland, but he was wearing a helmet, and he didn't sustain a brain injury, and he commented on that. So we are partnering up with Joey Harrington, and all the money that's raised at this dinner will go to buying helmets for children to help prevent brain injury. We give away about 1,000 helmets a year. We do a lot of prevention, and we do a lot of bike rodeos, and my granddaughter, everybody in my family works on brain injury. My granddaughter does a lot of this with me. She gives away helmets. She knows how to fit helmets properly, and I'm going to let her say hi in just a second. I know that our time is very, very limited. I want to say that we do about 10,000 calls a year, and we give out about 5,000 DVDs. One of the things I've learned is that people don't read very much anymore, and we are become an MTV generation, and so people will watch DVDs. So we send out a lot of DVDs. And
if you make it musical, Representative Thompson will listen to it. He loves it.
But we do have over 60 different DVDs for all different types.
Rap. I do rap too.
They can see that by looking at you. Sorry, Sherry, we're getting late in the day. I'm sorry.
What I want to highlight is that we do a training that it's always a we. It's never just me. Well, sometimes it's just me, but I try not to be just me. And I do it with Linda Van Doren from the Commission for the Blind, because like I said, a lot of people with brain injury lose their vision or part of their vision, and with Selina Miller, and Selina Miller works for the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation, and this is the training that I'd like to offer you, and it's a lot of different simulations. So we talk about different disabilities, whether it be mobility issues, vision issues, hearing issues, or invisible disabilities. And those invisible disabilities can be from a stroke, it can be from almost anything. George Clooney was filming Syriana And in one scene, the chair was kicked over. Do you remember this? And his head hit the ground. It tore the dura that wraps around the brain, and he has headaches to this day. And so it can affect anyone in an instant. You could have a heart attack. You could be near toxic mold. You could have chemotherapy. You could be in an automobile accident. Almost anything can cause a brain injury. Drugs, you know, drugs are a major problem. Domestic violence. And, I mean, I listened to most of these people talking, and I was like, that's all my population that's doing all the bad things. But so that's what we're here to help, is this. But I wanted do I have any questions?
Just to be clear, that's the training she mentioned is the one that Chair Tomei and I talked about. We'll get that training during our May interim days. So that's the second chapter of this presentation. Dr. Widener.
Thank you, Dr. Chair Gilliam.
I don't know where that came from.
I don't know either, but
you'll take it.
I guess I'll wear the title, not live up to it. Question, something when we go into this a little further, I would be interested in knowing the facts of just the effects on the brain from high fever in infants and children, because I know that does cause brain damage, and if they've seen what temperatures, what sustained parts of the temperatures, ear infections, those type of issues, and what type of effect they have on the brain, because I know those do cause brain damage as well. So
it does. It doesn't. Children need a higher fever, and children's fever, and when they reach 106 to 108, the brain will literally turn off, like a switch shut off. But that's 105, 106 is causing some issues. With adults, it can be 103 and 104. So when you have meningitis or encephalitis, then it's not uncommon to end up with a brain injury as an adult. And with the children, they don't usually get it as much. Where a children, every single one of us has had a brain injury, because you don't learn to walk without falling and hitting your head. Does it interfere with your everyday activities, your ADLs? And that's when it's a concern. So you might end up with learning disabilities. You might not read very well. Tom Cruise can't read a script. He has to have somebody read it to him, but he memorizes great. And so everybody has some issue. Can you learn strategies to compensate, and does it affect your long-term life? One of the things that I'm doing right now, and this training was developed for, was that the Forest Service is great at hiring people with various disabilities. But then once they hire them, they're not sure how to work with them, and people aren't sure how to, you know, the other people working with them aren't sure how to work with them. And so we've been traveling the state doing these trainings for the Forest Service and other employers and agencies as well, but teaching them that.
Thank you. Anybody else?
So I wanted Brianna to be able to say hi and to tell you a little bit. Do you want to tell them what you've done? She's shy. So she's worked the bike rodeos. I live in Molalla, you know, the thriving metropolis, and we've held a number of bike rodeos there, and she has helped fit other children for their helmets, and which is a three-point fitting system. And when I've done a lot of trainings and outreach with a FACT of Oregon, which is a family program, and so we give away helmets there. And here in Salem, I've given away over 1,000 helmets in the last 5 years at the Salem Park when they have different activities. So, yeah, we're very active.
Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate the brevity. That was the best presentation.
Well, do you want a cookie?
No.
You deserve one anyway. Now, any other comments or questions for this panel? Then thank you very much, Sherry.
I'll just make a comment, Sherry. Yes, it's cool. Always so good to see you, and I know we've heard from you over the years. It's certainly an issue, obviously, that's near and dear to your heart, and you've put a great deal of time and energy and effort into this, and I appreciate you continuing to work on this. And
thank you.
I
yeah, and it's
it, work with you.
You notice I wasn't here with any legislation this month.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, colleagues, thank you for your patience in being here. I hope you enjoyed that as much as we did. We'll continue to keep this spotlight on this kind of partnership. And with that, unless there are any other announcements or comments.
Do we have an agenda for Wednesday? We don't. But we may have one by tomorrow, right, or this evening, right? So is it just 24 hours notice?
For a public hearing, yes.
24 hours. Okay, notice. Thank you. Okay.
With that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Human Services. Thank you all.